Welcome to the Plant Cunning Podcast,
where we explore our relationship to plants, other people, and the mysteries of nature.
Coming to you from the High Allegheny Plateau in central New York,
we are your hosts, A.C. Staubel
and Isaac Hill.
Today on the Plant Cunning Podcast, we have John Michael Greer returning to talk about his book, The Secret of the Five Rites, and about the golden age of American occultism. It's going to be a fun discussion. You're going to like it. Before we get into that, I just want to share a couple announcements. The first is that we are having our Plant Cunning Conference live and in person on our small farm in central New York on the weekend of July 26th through 28th. And the tickets are not available yet, but mark your calendars. We've got a bunch of wonderful speakers, including Pam Montgomery, Seven Song, and a bunch of other herbalists, astrologers, and musicians. The other announcement is that I have been studying in this Vedic tradition of astrology, and I am doing readings now. So if you'd like to do a Vedic astrology reading with me, hit me up at info@plantcunning.com, and I can schedule you in a reading. I'm still learning, so this is for donation between us in a certain range. And so what I can do is look at your chart and see the basic karmic structure, archetypical structure, and framework of your life, and offer basic remedies for issues. So hit me up if you're interested in that. Also, if you like this podcast, please like and subscribe onto the YouTube. Give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, wherever you can see reviews, please give us a 5-star review and share with your friends. So thank you. Here is John.
Okay, so today on the Plant Cunning Podcast, we have John Michael Greer returning, and we're going to talk about The Secret of the Five Rites, the golden age of American occultism, and all sorts of other stuff in that genre. So how are you, John?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
And how's
well
your
exercised. Yoga? Well exercised.
Yeah, well exercised. Good. Yeah, we were just talking about how, before we hit record, how that these exercises are really good for masculine vigor. And I think this is a good thing to talk about while Mars is in Capricorn.
Ooh, yeah, good point.
There we go. Well, one of the discoveries that I made in the process of researching the Five Rites is that there were two publications. There was Peter Kelder's book, The Eye of Revelation, which came out from the little Los Angeles press that I talk about in my book. The Golden Dawn Press, by the way, and there's a story behind that. And then there was another publication in Denver, Colorado. And I forget the pseudonym of the guy who did that one, but it was four of the five rites. They didn't have the spinning around one. They didn't have the first rite. But it was four of them in a different order, and it was entirely about masculine vigor, wink, wink, nod, nod. It was a cure. It was an attempted treatment or cure for impotence.
I see.
And
yeah.
Exactly. You know, when they talked about masculine vigor in 1939, they did not mean general health or this kind of stuff. You could not at that time send anything through the mails that mentioned words like penis or orgasm or erection. You literally could not mention those things in anything that went through the U.S. mail. The
really?
Obscenity laws were very strict. And so you said things like masculine vigor and manliness and manhood and, you know, all this kind of thing, and hinted around and nodded and winked, and everyone generally got the idea. So on the one hand, you have these exercises being sold in pamphlet form as an ancient Hindu treatment for masculine vigor. And then you had, at the same time, within a few months, you had another publication in Los Angeles where you have the Five Rites being marketed as this amazing system of rejuvenatory exercises which would benefit you in all these various ways and activate these strained vortices within the body. And the advanced levels of the practice typically assume that you're going to be celibate rather than exercising the masculine vigor they were talking about there. So clearly there's a prehistory here. Clearly it's a complicated phenomenon. It's not just a matter of, you know, some guy comes back from the mystic east with these unusual exercises.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there is this, I mean, there's life force, and that can be expressed through masculine vigor, but can also be used.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same energy as the Kundalini. And I'm excited to delve into this topic and see, like, all the manifestations of this, but there is a really, it's in a way, it's the same energy.
Well, one of the basic traditions of occultism for many years has been the idea that all energy is interchangeable. Of course, your physicists will tell you this too. Mechanical energy can become electrical energy, can become heat energy, radiant energy, what have you. But the occultists got there early and often, and there was this sense that the vital energy, the life force within the body, can be expressed through sexuality, it can be expressed through magical action, it can be expressed through simple health and strength and vigor, it can be expressed through spiritual attainment, or quite possibly all of the above.
Right. Yeah, so there are some more questions I want to get into, more complicated questions regarding this, but maybe we should start off by talking about, like, what are the five rites? Where did they come from?
Okay, what they are is a set of the five rites, or five Tibetans, as they were called, even though they have nothing to do with Tibet. The five rites are a set of exercises, five of them, surprisingly enough. They are relatively simple exercises. The first one involves simply standing and rotating around with your arms extended a few times at first and gradually working up. And the other ones are exercises to work the muscles of the body core from the shoulders through the hips. And they're very down to the knees. They're very straightforward exercises. Most people can do them without too much difficulty. They are not postures like yoga. They are actually movements. You begin doing them, each of the five rites, three times each, and you gradually work up over a period of weeks until you're doing 21 reps of each of the rites, and that's what you do for the rest of your life. There are exercise teachers and practitioners today, people who have an extensive background in different kinds of exercise, who consider the five rites the foundation of their personal exercise practice because it is a really good general workout. You know, you may also want to do other things. You may want to lift weights. You may want to do specialized exercises. But just for overall vigor and vitality and masculine vigor and all the whatever you like, it's a good exercise routine. It takes, to begin with, it's going to take you like 5-6 minutes. It works out to about a little under half an hour when you're at the doing all 21 of each. So it's not time consuming. It doesn't require complicated equipment. It's, it's, as they say nowadays, bodyweight exercise.
Mm-hmm. And why 21?
Our text does not explain.
Okay. That's just what works.
This is one of the things you have to get used to in occult literature generally is that people will make these grave pronouncements about, 21 times, and then thou shalt count to three, unto four shalt thou not count, or what have you, and never explain why. Interestingly, the other version of these same exercises, the masculine vigor version published in Denver, Colorado, at the same time that the more famous set was published in Los Angeles, it's not three working up to 21, it's two working up to 20. Again, there is no explanation.
Yeah.
Might be, 21's divisible by seven, and seven is this profound number, so maybe it's something to do...
It might be that, and very likely, if you were to ask a teacher of that, they say, I recommend you meditate on that.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, you see. That's one of the secrets of the trade. If the student asks you a puzzling question, you just fix them with that look and say, meditate on that, Chela.
Nice pro tip there.
You will understand much, O Lanu. Yes.
It's just interesting now, that it was like there's sort of a limit. Like you might think like you just keep progressing as you get stronger or whatever. And you a part about the whirling dervishes who do that first one, the spin move, many times, but it might sort of affect their knee vortex.
Certainly the text, the Av Revelation, suggests that spending all your time spinning around will mess up your vortices in various ways. The vortices, by the way, or vortexes, as the book says, are seven centers in the body, and no, not the seven you're thinking of. These are not the chakras.
Mm-hmm.
They are rather oddly placed at first glance. There are one in each of the knees, one at the root of the penis or the clitoris, one in roughly the place of the liver, one at the base of the throat, and then two inside the brain, roughly in the positions of the pineal and pituitary glands. So those are your seven. Those are the seven vortices. And we can go into that in more detail too, because those do not pop up out of nowhere. There's a trail you can follow. You asked, where do these come from? That is the $64,000 question.
Okay.
Because in the book, The Eye of Revelation by Peter Kelder, that introduced these things, it's all in the form of this fictional story where this Colonel Bradford guy, who's British and spent a lot of his time in India, has gone back to the Himalayas because he has heard there is this lamasery somewhere where they will teach these mysterious ways of rejuvenation. He's a very old man. He wants to be young and healthy again. He comes back after a while, and the narrator mistakes him for his own son. He looks that rejuvenated. And so Colonel Bradford proceeded to teach our narrator and then a class of old men how to rejuvenate themselves through these five rites. That's the book. Now, there seems to be no evidence whatsoever that there ever was a Colonel Bradford. And the idea that this came from the Mystic East, that was one of the most common sales pitches in the occult scene at that time. As I note in my book, you could at that time go down to any African-American hoodoo shop in Los Angeles, of which there were quite a few, and find bottles of China water and this kind of stuff, all various Hindu-flavored or Chinese-flavored things. And they had absolutely nothing to do with India or China. It was pure sales.
Yeah.
In the same way, does the name George Adamski ring a bell with either of you?
No.
Okay. You don't follow the oddities of very early UFO lore. Adamski was the first famous contactee. He claimed to have been visited by an alien from Venus, who met him in the California desert and this kind of stuff. George Adamski, before he got into the UFO trade, ran an organization called the Royal Order of Tibet. It was an occult school in the Los Angeles area. It had a correspondence course, which I would love to get. And it actually had its own radio program for a while. Now, it had nothing to do with Tibet.
Right.
It had no more to do with Tibet than it had to do with royalty. It was absolutely standard early 20th century American occult teaching. But,
But doesn't this also go back all the way to, like, Apollonius going to India to...
Yeah, Apollonius Tiana was said to have gone to India. Pythagoras, by some of his later fanboys, was said to have gone to India to learn all kinds of wisdom. They had him literally going all over the world and getting initiated by everybody. Yeah, it's a grand old thing. I mean, Pythagoras himself supposedly went to Egypt and studied at the feet of the mystic Egyptian priest. It's a standard shtick.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what you need to do for marketing. But the point is that the five rites have, there's no evidence that they have any connection to the Mystic East at all. And it doesn't help that the other publication, the Denver publication, claims they're not some mysterious Tibetan rites, but mysterious Hindu rites. Okay. So you get very clearly the sense that these rites may or may not be mysterious, but any attribution of location should be taken as a sales pitch. Now, in the course of trying to trace them back, best I can do, because there isn't a lot of documentary evidence, but the best I can do is see there's some evidence that basically they were invented over a course of about 30 years in the United States, or possibly the U.S. and Canada, by various circles of occultists working with a set of exercises that had first been introduced by William Walker Atkinson, the colossus of early 20th century American occultism, the man of a million aliases. It turns out he was all three of the three adepts who wrote the Kybalion. He was Theron Q. Dumont, who wrote books on concentration and willpower. He was Swami Panchadasi, who wrote books on Indian mysticism, and Swami Ramacharaka was the other one. He had two different Hindu aliases, and he had other aliases still. He got around. But his book Hatha Yoga, which was one of the Ramacharaka books, includes a set of exercises which are kind of very rough first drafts of four of the five rites. And so since, occultists love to talk about traditions, they love to talk about how this is ancient stuff handed down from the dawn of time. And whereas occultists in the real world are constantly inventing things. They're constantly tinkering. They're constantly testing out. They're taking new things and saying, if I change that, it's going to work with this. And then the result gets marketed again as an ancient tradition passed on from the dawn of time. So that's the process that, as far as I can tell, gave us the five rites, this sort of rolling period of experimentation within circles in the American occult scene.
Right. But there still does seem to be some sort of influence in terms of, like, there are similarities to yoga, to Hatha yoga poses.
There are, yes, but the thing is, the human body can only move in so many ways.
Right.
And the thing to keep in mind is that Hatha yoga poses are, you strike a posture and you hold it.
Yeah.
Now, that's not true in every version of yoga, but certainly the versions of yoga that were widely circulated in America before about 1980. It was, you strike a posture, you strike an asana, and there you are. The five rites are not like that. The five rites, you are constantly moving.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I've been told from people who have a background in Kumnai, which is a Tibetan exercise system, that there are movements in Kumnai that look kind of like the five rites.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been told by a guy with an extensive background in, I think it's Bagua, one of the Chinese internal arts, that he was taught a set of exercises very much like the five rites as this ancient Chinese system. It's entirely possible that somebody in China got a hold of a copy of the Eye of Revelation and said, wow, these are good. Let's try it. Let's modify them.
Yeah.
It's a mystery, kind of.
But there still is, I think this is a topic I would like to go into a little bit too, like
mm-hmm.
how different traditions, esoteric traditions from different cultures, are constantly cross-pollinated.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And like, even like today, we can see that happening.
And today and yesterday and 100 years ago and 1,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
One of the research, just as an example, before we get into the nitty gritty of the five rites, there is a diagram called the Tai Chi Tu, which is Chinese. It mm-hmm. was introduced by a Neo-Confucian mystic. And I think the book was published in 1071. It's a version of the Tree of Life.
Yeah,
the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. Now, the really unnerving thing is that it shows up in Chinese sources about 100 years before the first version of the Tree of Life in Jewish literature.
Yeah.
So yes, things get around, stuff gets swapped, and especially, you know, again, cycling back to the 1930s, China was not on a different planet at that point. There was a lot of interest in Chinese communities in what incomparable traditions in the West, also in India. You know, a lot of people in India read Western physical culture literature, including a lot of yoga practitioners. They were looking at it, going, what can we do with this? They were doing the same thing in China. And equally, of course, people in Los Angeles and other parts of North America were paging through stuff from India and China and going, wow, this is good. We can modify that and put it into our thing. So yes, there's this constant process of interchange. Another good example, Manly P. Hall, one of the great names of American occultism. Nothing that I've read of his work actually comes out and says this in so many words, but he has all the necessary knowledge that he would have only been able to get if he had been actually formally initiated into the Shingon school of Buddhism, which is Japanese esoteric Buddhism, okay? When you think of like mandalas and things like that, you think Tibet, right? There are two schools in Japan, the Shingon and Tendai schools, that are the same kind of esoteric Buddhism with the Vajras and all this kind of stuff. And there was some kind of Shingon presence in California at that time. I haven't been able to chase down the details yet. But here's Manly P. Hall, and he has an encyclopedic knowledge of the two big Shingon mandalas. And he hints in one of his books that his tarot deck, the one that he designed and Augustus Knapp made, is actually keyed into these two Shingon mandalas. He knows an enormous amount about that end of esoteric Buddhism. So here's this crossover again. Here's this flow back and forth between, in this case, esoteric Japanese Buddhism and Manly P. Hall, you know, as one of the great figures of American occultism of the time.
Yeah, and like as I've been studying Vedic astrology too, I'm seeing how mm-hmm. similar it is to Western astrology, but how different it is too,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
how the cultural context is very important.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
like same with the Kabbalah, like the mm-hmm. the Hebrew words of power,
mm-hmm.
like, the way it's structured, like they're all it's very precisely keyed into the culture, but the mm-hmm. idea still moves and changes.
Oh yeah, yeah. Paul Foster Case, one of the major American figures in the development of the occult end of the Kabbalah, used to refer to the Kabbalah as the ageless wisdom. And you know, with all due respect, he was absolutely wrong. There's nothing ageless about any esoteric tradition, the Kabbalah or otherwise. The version of the Kabbalah he was studying was something that evolved in Anglo-American culture in the late 19th century. He himself developed it and expanded it and added things to it, and people picked up from him and did more stuff with it. So doubtless there's a timeless core at the heart of it, but everything else is constantly in flux. Everything else is growing and reshaping and developing. And so whether it's the evolution of the occult Kabbalah out of the Renaissance Christian Kabbalah, out of the Jewish Kabbalah, out of the Greek Middle Platonic and Pythagorean traditions, and out of Gnosticism ultimately, that all of that came through, it's this constant process of flow and change.
Yeah. And then so with the five rites, we have the concept of the Kundalini and the transmutation of energy, but done in a safe way, which is important in the West where we don't have those teachers. So
you see, and that's a very important thing. The Kundalini, there's a confusion here because there's a current, very popular current system of Kundalini yoga, the one that was created and marketed by Yogi Bhajan, which is perfectly safe. You know, it is something that suburban housewives do in large numbers, and none of them, or as far as I know, no significant number of them are ending up with their nervous systems fried. But Yogi Bhajan took an older tradition and stepped it down to make it safe. Mm-hmm. If you go back to the older literature, you find gruesome warnings, and I'm including literature from India, literature from people who were hanging out with Kundalini yogins, and they're saying, yeah, you know, you may achieve total enlightenment this way. You may also fry your nervous system and kill yourself. You know, if you want to go for the gut, if you want to go for it, be ready to take risks. And since this was tolerably well known, because the Theosophical Society publicized these warnings because they were rather nervous about people doing any kind of esoteric practice besides a little light meditation. And so there was this big move on the part of people in Western esoteric circles to find ways to work with the Kundalini energy, work with that center of energy at the base of the spine, the flows of energy up the spine, and find a way to do it without causing people to drop dead in their tracks. And
why the risk to activate your Kundalini in that way?
Because you're dealing with something that ties into the core of your central nervous system and the entire system by which the nerves manage the ductless glands, the endocrine glands. If your endocrine glands go haywire, you die. It really is that simple. One of the things that people found out back, I think in the 19th century, for example, is, you know, if somebody has this occasionally happens, you have a brain cancer that spreads into the pituitary gland, okay? Sometimes they would do surgery and cut away the pituitary gland because it had become cancerous. If you did that, no matter what else you did, the patient died within 3 days.
Wow.
Because the pituitary gland governs the endocrine system. And if it's not there to govern it, your whole body basically just freaks out and shuts down.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So because the Kundalini works with the endocrines and it works with the central nervous system, you know, the spinal process all the way up through the medulla and so on, which is what keeps your body, like, breathing, the heart beating, digestion, all this kind of stuff, mess with that unconsciously and you die.
Yeah.
Or, you know, incompetently. So coming up with gentle ways to do that was a growth industry at the time. And Yogi Bhajan kind of ended up filling the market for that, because by his time you actually had teachers in the Mystic East. Nobody had to put up with George Adamski and so on anymore. And so, but some of these older systems, you know, like the middle pillar exercise in Golden Dawn Magic, Guru Vigardi created it. It's a very effective system for working energy up and down the midline of the body that does not run the same risks. It doesn't work with the spine. There's a system that I've been putting a lot of work into reviving and you know, blowing the dust off of and getting into people's hands, which doesn't use the spine either. It works with the vagus nerve, which is the one bundle of nerves in the body that goes from the brain and into the body and doesn't go through the spine. It goes from the brain straight down along the neck and in two branches, and then spreads all through the viscera and connects to the solar plexus and all the other nerve plexuses and the stomach and everything. And so there was this extensive system that was developed where you're working with the solar plexus and you're working with the vagus nerve, and basically, where Kundalini very often works like a fire hose, this is just turning the tap on very gently.
Awesome.
And it gives you a slow, gentle trickle up to the pineal gland to set off the various electrochemical processes, and it's very gentle. And so I figured, there will always be people who want to go the fire hose route, but let's provide a nice, simple, safe method for the rest of us.
So Five Rights works with the ductless glands too, the safe way. So
But
what are the ductless glands?
okay, ductless glands,
Some of them.
aka endocrine glands. They are a set of glands that are spread all through the body. There are the ones everyone knows about, the testes or ovaries, the adrenals, the thymus, the thyroid, the pituitary gland, the pineal gland. There are also lots of little ones and just little clusters of cells scattered all through the body. There's also a little object at the base of just in front of the bottom of the spine, just in front of your tailbone, called the coccygeal glomus, which looks like a ductless gland. And Western physicians and anatomists have never been able to figure out what it does. Of course, yogins in India have known what it does for thousands of years. That's the base chakra. That's where the Kundalini is stored.
Well, if it quacks like a duckless gland,
Ouch.
must be.
Yes, but if you mention that among Western doctors, they call you a quack.
I see.
So.
I see. So, is there a relationship between the duckless glands and those seven vortices?
It's a very indirect one. One of the things that fascinated me, and let's talk a little bit about the seven vortices in terms of their history and so on, because that was really the clue that helped me pop open what was going on with the five rights. Because you have these seven vortices, these oddly placed centers within the body, the two in the knees and so on, going on in the writings of Peter Kelder's book, The Eye of Revelation. You also have those in Rosicrucian literature at the same time. American Rosicrucians like Max Heindel, the Rosicrucian Cosmo Conception, has diagrams of exactly those centers. I happen to be a member of another Rosicrucian organization, not the Amoric one in California. It's the Societas Rosicruciana in America, the SRIA. And its lessons also have those seven vortices. And George Plummer, who was the founder of the SRIA, was not a student of Max Heindel. So both of them were getting it from a common source, almost certainly in Europe. And so I did some research and noted that all these vortices are actually known as minor centers, or in some cases actual chakras, in Hindu tradition, but you actually have to know a lot about Hindu tradition to realize that. For example, those knee centers, those are actually, they're a set of minor chakras that go down the legs. And they key into states of consciousness below the Muladhara, below the material plane. If you deal with them, you have to deal with various negative emotional patterns and so on. But each of them also ties into one or more of the major chakras. So if you work with those knee centers, you're actually very gently stimulating the root chakra. You're not doing it directly, so you don't have to worry about the overwhelming upflow of stuff that could fry your nervous system, but you're very gently stimulating it. And so on and so forth. So basically, somebody who knew a lot about, either they knew a heck of a lot about yoga traditions, which, in some parts of Central Europe people did in, say, 1900 or 18, the 1890s and so on, or they simply knew a lot about the subtle energies of the human body, put together these seven vortices and said, okay, if you work with these, this is a gentle approach that will allow you to release the Kundalini as a gentle trickle rather than a fire hose. And so Peter Kelder, or whoever's, because Peter Kelder is a pseudonym, We're pretty sure of that. Whoever was behind him, whatever tradition might have been behind him, seems to be the one that noticed that the five rites stimulate these seven vortices. And so you combine the exercises with a set of existing practices, we're using concentration and visualization of the vortices to activate them.
Mm-hmm. And so that's what you talk about in the book is, because he doesn't necessarily talk about the visualizations in the Eye of Revelation.
No, he doesn't talk about them at all. the Eye of Revelation, I'm pretty, in retrospect, as I've done further research in this, the little press that published it, the Golden Dawn Press, was the house press of a little Los Angeles area occult group with of Rosicrucian connections, headed by a guy named Harry J. Gardner. And Harry Gardner was a small to mid-sized occult teacher in the Los Angeles area. He had these monographs that he sold and did fairly well by them. They're strange stuff. It was sort of esoteric Christianity and a lot of stuff about the Great Pyramid. And this was his public stuff. And he never quite goes so far as to say this out loud, but I'm pretty sure that if you wrote to him after completing some of the stuff and said, I want to learn more, and you were in the Los Angeles area, you'd get an invite to be interviewed and then become a member of his lodge. He clearly had one. I'm guessing that the Eye of Revelation was part of that, part of the publicity movement for that. So you get the Eye of Revelation out, you get this book in circulation, and then people get in touch with you and say, wow, I've practiced the five rites and I've had these interesting experiences. Can I learn more? Then they come in for the interview and become members of your lodge. What exactly else might have been part of the system, we don't know. I haven't found out yet. But one of the reasons why you have these books that are obviously incomplete, that don't tell you the whole system, that don't tell you the whole story, is that they're bait.
Yeah.
And there was a huge amount of that in early 20th century America. You could find dozens of such volumes. I mean, the Rosicrucians, the Amok Rosicrucians, the guys from San Jose, they had this booklet called The Mastery of Life, which they would send to you free of charge. And it was all, it didn't actually tell you much, but it was a sales brochure for their correspondence courses.
Mm-hmm.
And some people did that very obvious, blatant, join our order, get our courses, pay us lots of money, and we'll teach you the secrets of the universe. Others, like Harry Gardner, were a little subtler about it, and somebody put out these monographs explaining how you could achieve, these spiritual things, and here are some basic exercises, and here are some basic exercises. And, there are not so basic exercises, but those are reserved to the initiates.
Marketing, you gotta get the word out.
You gotta get the word out. One way or another, occultists also have bills to pay. They gotta pay the rent. They gotta keep food on the table.
Yeah. So what are some of the results that people, would experience or could expect from having their vortices activated?
The first thing that tends to happen is, as in fact Peter Kelder's book explains, it tends to involve increased vitality and improved health.
Hmm.
Because, we're talking about the life energy. We're talking about the life force within the body. And the basic theory, which is common, by the way, to yoga, to Chinese Qigong, to Western occultism, is that a lot of what causes old age, a lot of what causes debility and sickness is blockage of the life force. It gets the channels get crudded up, or you get the life force gets slack, you don't have adequate flow through your body, and so you get old and weak and tired, and away we go. If you can activate these vortices, you're activated, you're getting the flow going again, you feel, more vigorous, more chipper and cheerful. Now, each of the vortices also ties into different aspects of the subtle body in occult theory. And you can also, working with the vortices, not just in terms of the five rites, but in terms of some of the meditative practices, you can use those to open the Eye of Revelation. By the way, that's something that Kelder never explains. He titles his book The Eye of Revelation. And he ends the thing with his narrator going, surely now the Eye of Revelation is open upon the world. What is the Eye of Revelation? He never says.
Yeah, you got to wait for book two.
And there was never a book two.
Yeah.
the eye, actually, if you read occult literature from the time, it's clear the Eye of Revelation is the pineal gland.
Hmm.
which is in fact a little eye inside the center of the brain.
Yeah.
And when it is activated, it produces certain modes of perception, certain modes of clairvoyant perception, spiritual perception. It's the one eye that opens. And that's the eye of revelation. And in fact, the five rites won't get you there all by themselves, but they'll give you a definite boost in that direction. And a range of other exercises that were well-known in the occult community cover the rest of it. I talk about a fair amount of that in my book, The Secret of the Five Rites. I also have a forthcoming book that will cover it from a different angle. And that's the book that I have out called The Way of the Golden Section is the first of a trilogy. Mm-hmm. There's The Way of the Golden Section, The Way of the Four Elements, and The Way of the Secret Temple. And The Way of the Secret Temple includes a lot of material along these lines.
Cool. And does that relate to the temple technology books?
Indirectly, yes. It doesn't really work well, you know. If I'm trying to give out a set of practices that most people can do, I'm not going to say, okay, now go buy a piece of land in an appropriate area and build this stone temple. It's a little right. bit of a problem for most people, but there are references to it. There are material borrowed from the sort of creation of a temple in the imagination and so on. That became part of the temple tradition as it evolved over the years, and that flows into the Way of the Secret Temple.
One of the things I like about the work you've been doing is sort of reviving these golden age American occultist golden age ideas and practices, and at a time when like people talk about Madeline P. Hall and so on, but they're also kind of looked at by serious magicians and serious occultists as kind of, you know, soft or not real. they have so many lies.
Oh, yeah.
Another thing to talk about is how they're not really this ancient tradition or ancient technology. They're not really from the Far East. They're not really hermetic, you know, like the Kabbalion. But
the Kabbalion, is new thought it borrows some stuff from the Corpus Hermeticum, no question. But it's mostly new thought. But the thing is, American occultism, about the same time that the quote British invasion in music, about the time the Beatles and all these other British bands came over, we had a British invasion in occultism. And we went through a period of, I was young at that time, we went through a period of some years where if it was not invented in Britain, between the founding of the Golden Dawn and whenever Gerald Gardner finished forging his first Book of Shadows, nobody wanted to hear about it. It had to be either Golden Dawn or Aleister Crowley or one of the early versions of Wicca or various ripoffs thereof. Or people just, they not only weren't they interested, they'd never heard of it.
Yeah.
And I think I link this also to the popularity of J.R.R. Tolkien. And generally of English-themed fantasy. An enormous number of people piled into this idea that magic was all about cloaks and swords and basically 12th century Britain, castles and witches and all this kind of stuff, and forgot that America had its own esoteric tradition. It was all this flight to ye olde England.
Yeah. What are some of the main threads in American occultism? It seems to me, too, like there's a more of a Central European thread, too, with Rosicrucianism and Heimdall.
It's complicated.
Yeah.
Okay. American occultism, there are like three main currents that flowed into it early on. Mm-hmm. There's unquestionably a British current. And I say British because it was at least as much Scottish and Welsh and Cornish and Irish as it was English. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you had this British current bringing in a lot of, on the one hand, British folk magic, on the other hand, British occultism, because Britain was one of the few places in Europe where you could for many years publish books of occultism in English, not in Latin, so anybody could use them. But we have the English translations of Cornelius Agrippa. We have William Lilly's path-breaking works on astrology written in English rather than Latin, and so on. So that was a very powerful influence. The second current came from, Central Europe is a good term because there was no country called Germany yet. in those days, it was a whole bunch of tiny little countries that all spoke versions of the same language. And so you had this huge Central European flow, especially, but not only in Pennsylvania. And then, of course, you had the African impulse brought by enslaved Africans. And these three patterns really merged and flowed together and borrowed from each other in the usual way. So you had that going. And then you started getting the homegrown stuff. You started getting new thought. Phineas Quimby pops up in right after the Civil War and starts teaching about the power of the mind. Mm-hmm. And you have, of course, spiritualism, 1848. The three little girls talk to a ghost, and the world goes nuts. And you have mesmerism. You have the traveling mesmerists who would do basically shows where they'd hypnotize people and use the power of animal magnetism to pay audiences. And all of this flowed and built and changed and produced a long series of intricate occult teachings. And of course, then you started to get later, once the European occult revival began in the 1850s, you started getting some of these traditions coming over you. People were reading Eliphas Levi, people were reading, once the Golden Dawn types started to producing, that was very popular. And it's just this permanent, rolling, creative mass building across the United States.
So what was Los Angeles like in the golden age of occultism?
Well, now there's a tendency that I'll refer to briefly as we get to get to Los Angeles. There's usually one city somewhere in the country that is kind of ground zero for occultism. And actually, it was Philadelphia in colonial times. It was Boston in the federal period. It moved to Chicago later. Chicago was a heck of an occult center in the late 19th and early 20th century. And then it went to Los Angeles. Los Angeles was cheap. Rents were low back in those days. And an enormous number of occult traditions ended up there. And so it was this vast, bubbling culture. And there's a lot of money. You have Hollywood beginning to hit its stride. And so there was vast amounts of money from that. The aviation industry was big there. There were a lot of other technological industries that were very lucrative. And so there was a huge amount of money to be had. And so occultists could usually find some way to make a living. If you read fiction from Los Angeles at the time, I'm thinking of Raymond Chandler's noir private eye novels, occultists show up. And of course, since it's noir, there were fake occultists. But but so there was a lot of stuff going on there. It was the place to be if you wanted to study, if you wanted to get really deep. There in New York City was the other real pole. Of course, the New York City was the big literary pole at that time. And so those were the kind of the two hubs around which American occultism ebbed and flowed. And of course, during the golden age of American occultism, every city of any size had a lodge of the Theosophical Society. It had various other schools and teachers and so on. It had a half a dozen Rosicrucian organizations. That was all over the place. But yeah, Los Angeles was big. Los Angeles had one of the very few American temples of the Golden Dawn. And it had just all kinds of stuff. And
that's where, like, there were multiple different Rosicrucian traditions started there. Ananda start his Self-Realization Fellowship there.
So, yeah.
And so, yeah.
Well, a lot of them didn't start there. For example, we mentioned Max Heindel a while ago. Mm. He actually originally started his Rosicrucian Fellowship in Seattle, Washington.
Mm.
But it wasn't really a good place for him, and so he ended up moving to just north of San Diego at Oceanside, which is where they're still headquartered. And because not everyone settled in Los Angeles proper, but Southern California, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Theosophists having a big presence there. You have various Rosicrucian groups having a big presence there, and so on and so on and so on. You know, pick an occult tradition, any occult tradition. One of the reasons why that fell out of fashion, of course, is that most of those occult traditions were not deeply into ceremonial magic. They were not trying to make the world behave. They were mostly seeking to develop the intuitive faculties, to develop clairvoyance, to develop divinatory abilities and so on, a lot of stuff with tarot or what have you. So that instead of trying to make the world do what you want, you figure out where your best options are and simply go there. And so it was a subtler and in some ways a gentler approach to occultism. It was very popular in those days. During America's period as a global empire, that fell out of fashion. Everyone was just, no, we're the big guys. We're going to muscle our way. And I think that filtered down all through our culture.
Ah, that's a really interesting point.
People got very fixated on this idea of, no, you have to force the world. And of course, the popularity of Aleister Crowley, once he was safely dead.
Right.
When Crowley was alive, nobody wanted to deal with him. The guy was a jerk. But once he was safely dead, and especially during the 60s when Grady McMurtry revived the OTO and said, well, this is cool. Let's have some fun with it. People think of Crowley as the founder of the Thelemite tradition. Grady McMurtry did more to found it than Crowley ever did. Mm-hmm. He was more laid back. He was more approachable. I never met him, but I know people who did, and he was a very likable guy. And so, you know, he was, but you know, Crowley had that very masculine vigor approach to things.
right.
And he was out to thrust his way into the. And so, you know, that really helped feed this notion of magic as the almighty ego belaboring the universe with its power,
right,
rather than the older, gentler occult approach of, okay, there's a world of possibilities open to me. What if I can see the unseen, if I can perceive what is hidden, I can go to the place where what I want is going to drop gently into my hand.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so interesting, that pattern that you've noticed, because it really does seem like after World War II, once America gains the ascendancy and is the hegemon of the world, that sort of power and control type magic becomes a lot more popular.
Exactly, it becomes a lot more popular. And one of the reasons that as the United States is busy, basically, I have been really putting some energy into getting this older approach back out there because I think a lot of people are ready for it.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people are tired of this sort of vast throbbing. And there I go with Crowley again.
Yeah, right.
Yes, this sort of vast throbbing overinflated ego and are looking at, okay, is there a gentler way to do things? Is there a way that is not about bullying the cosmos? Like, you know, the New Age notion that you can tell the cosmos, the secret, which was never a secret, of course, the law of attraction, where if you just want something badly enough, you can guilt trip the universe into giving it to you. What?
We're all tired. What? We need a softer approach. Yeah.
We need a softer approach. The vast throbbing phallic ego has had its day.
Mm-hmm.
Let's try something a little less stupid. And so a lot of these older, the vast majority of these older American occult traditions were very much into that other thing. If you read Paul Foster Case, if you read Manly P. Hall, if you read George Winslow Plummer or Max Heindel or any of these people, you're not going to find, and this is how you conjure spirits from the deep and, you know, bully them into doing what you want. It's, you know, no, this is how you develop your intuition. This is how you develop visionary capacities. This is how you change how you think and how you act so the world responds to you differently. Because the one common feature of all of your problems is you.
Yeah.
You know, and you can benefit a lot more and you can gain a lot more by working on yourself than you can by strutting around, you know, expecting the world to cater to you.
Yeah.
Totally.
And as a druid, you see the binary and you turn into a ternary.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
In the world, America in 1900, 1920, 1940 was very different than the America that we're entering into. I mean, we can look at Uranus moving into Gemini again, Neptune changing. Like, it seems like the next 10 years are going to be very, like, it would be a very different America and a very different world than the world happening right now.
The thing is, back in 2020, December 21st, 2020, when we passed through the Great Mutation, the conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn moved into a sign of a different element. In traditional mundane astrology, that is hugely important. That ushers in an entirely new age of the world that lasts for 200 odd years.
Yeah, the age of
and
air.
So, yeah, exactly. We're going from the age of Earth into the age of air. And so we had this particular pattern that was set in motion in what was it? 1920, I think it was, right around then. And little after that, I could look up the date. But at any rate, where certain very unusual planetary aspects were involved in the chart of that grand mutation. And, for example, the moon just dominated that whole thing. And so you have the rise of democratic governments, you have the rise of feminism, you have just a whole galaxy of other things, you have a lot of radical changes. That age has run its course.
Right.
And so all of these things that have changed, that have dramatically reshaped the world for 200 years, that's over with now. And we're moving into a very different world where there are different changes, different revolutionary transformations, different, you know, Jupiter is opening a different set of doors, and Saturn is closing a bunch of older doors.
Exactly.
And so we really don't have a lot of experience yet with Uranus and Neptune.
Yeah.
Because they've only been discovered for a certain period of time. But astrologers have been watching the great mutations and the conjunctions of Jupiter and Saturn for a very long time. There's a lot of first-rate information on that, which is one of the things I've studied quite a bit of late, trying to get a sense of what that is. But yeah, you know, the point being that we're in a new world now. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the things that have been standard, have been just goes without saying for the last 200 years, are not true anymore.
Yeah. So what does the future of American occultism look like to you? Like, it does make sense for it to be softer and less dominant.
Well, basically, the future, it's impossible to say in advance because it will depend on who does what.
Ah, yeah.
The future is not given to us. The future is something we make by our actions and our inactions. And something we attract to us with our attitudes. If those are stupid attitudes, we get a stupid future. And so that, you know, it's the future of American occultism depends entirely on who gets into it and what do they do with it. One of the things that seems to be happening right now is that on the one hand, a lot of the sort of last 50 years of occultism is guttering, or last 40 years is guttering out. A lot of the big pagan conventions and pagan, you know, events have shut down. It used to be that practically every city of any size had at least one witch, you know, witch shop with the books and the tools and the herbs and things like that. Most of those are gone. Sales of occult literature peaked in 2007, have been dropping ever since. Same for New Age, same for most of that. That whole cluster of things really reached its peak and started fading. At the same time, there are other things rising up.
Yep.
There are a lot of older materials that have become available for the first time in centuries. I mean, you can get detailed accounts of the old Ars Notoria, the system of magic for speeding up your learning process.
Yeah, that's amazing.
We just interviewed Matthias.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I got a copy of his book for the price of a blurb.
Wow. And, congrats!
It's an excellent book. Actually, the thing is, I now have both his and Stephen Skinner's version, and they're both good. And I think actually, if you really want to do the thing, you probably want both sets. But but this stuff is available now.
Right.
30 years ago, I was looking for some way to find even the most basic material on the Ars Notoria. You could not get it for love nor money.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And now, you know, go down to go to your favorite online bookstore and order a copy, and there you are, thump.
Yeah, right. It's literally a thump. It's
one of the things that is the urge for the traditional occultism and the traditional knowledge, like the grimoire revival, is has already kind of peaked in a certain way. Like the Picatrix that you helped translate, and then I'm studying in this Vedic tradition that it wasn't possible to study this unless you went to India and somehow managed to find the right teacher, you know?
Yeah, somebody who's taken a gringo, yeah.
Right. So like these very traditional forms of astrology and magic are now finally available, and they're just so much more potent too, especially than like the neo-pagan kind of Wicca magic.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, the neo-pagan stuff, there's an important difference here, and it dates from one day. October 31st, 1979, that was when Starhawk's The Spiral Dance and Margot Adler's Drawing Down the Moon were published on the same date, one in Boston, one in San Francisco. And those marked the coming of lightweight, feel-good pop culture Wicca. And, you know, where it's all about feeling empowered. It's not about actually being able to do anything.
Yeah. It's just the intention, not the action.
Exactly. And you know, it was all just, it's more posturing. You know, I feel so powerful. Okay, so what can you do? And I know people, I knew more of them, so many of them passed on at this point, who actually were trained in some of the older pagan traditions in trad Wicca and so on, who were horrified by this stuff. They were saying, this is bubble gum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you had a huge amount of that, and that thankfully is collapsing rapidly around us right now. And that's, you know, it's fine. There was a book published in the 1960s called The Coming Great Golden Age of Occultism. I forgot the name of the author right now. But he predicted, on the basis of complex astrological things, that we were going to be going into about a 36-year golden age of pop occultism, where there's going to be occultism all over the place. And it was published in like 67, and in the 70s it hit. And so we had this great wave of popular occultism. And now it seems to be cycling back down to a more normal situation where there are people who are into it and most other people are going, huh?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, which is fine. It's probably healthier. And so, yeah, you know, more of these traditions are coming out, and I'm hoping that some of the better aspects of trad American occultism become part of that revival, that get picked up in the people use them and do constructive things with them, because there's a lot of good stuff you can do with them.
Yeah,
it may not be as romantic as a grimoire or the Ars Notoria or the Picatrix, for that matter, but you really can change your life in constructive ways by using these things.
Yeah, well, thank you for helping to bring so many of these ideas and concepts and practices and texts back.
Well, you're welcome. I am a dumpster diver, okay? I go through the back alleys of Western history, flip open the dumpster, say, oh, look at this, barely touched. I hold that. You know, that's what I do.
Yeah, you're darn good at it.
Yeah,
but it's, you know,
it's
fun.
Yeah. Right. And that's like what Western esotericism is to a certain degree. It's mm-hmm. like all of the ideas and practices that you had to put in the dumpster because they weren't appropriate for the mainstream anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Dive with the dominant paradigms.
Mm.
Yeah, exactly. And we've been through several cycles of this now, mm-hmm. in the biggest way with the coming of Christianity. And most of the old classical occultism got thrown into the dumpster. And then it got pulled out by a lot of very good dumpster divers in the Renaissance. And then that got thrown into the dumpster with this coming of the scientific revolution. And then we had the rebirth of Western occultism starting in the 1850s with L.S. Levy and going on through to about the beginning of the Second World War. And then that got thrown into the dumpster. And now we're pulling, you know, various people are pulling stuff out of all three of these things.
Mm-hmm.
We've got people who are digging up classical occultism, people who are digging up Renaissance occultism, and people who are digging up the modern stuff. And, you know, hopefully there will be a little less resort to dumpsters in the future and more people just getting working systems and going, okay, now let's see what this baby will do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
You said this quote in Magic Monday, I think it was yesterday, about how it's like not so much traditions as individual magicians and occultists who are doing, have their own grab bag of practices. And that's different than just like grabbing this and that and mishmashing it together. It's core competencies in all these.
Think of L.F.S. Levy, think of, actually better still, John Dee. Okay. Uh-huh. D did not follow a tradition. He was very well educated. He knew his classical occult sources. He knew a lot about Renaissance occultism. He put together from his knowledge of these things a coherent system. And then he worked the bejesus out of it. And that was normal. If you read through any of the occultists, the great occultists of the Renaissance, they're not slavishly following a specific tradition. They're taking everything, what they can find, they're putting together a system out of it, and then working that. Maybe other people will take up that system from them, But every one of those other people who does it, the way Thomas Rudd did with Dee's work, changed it, tinkered with it. You know, oh, this would work a little better if we twist it. Like, okay, yeah, there we go. And so, yeah. So there, you know, traditions get, or the idea of tradition can be very overdone.
Yeah, especially in the West.
Especially when, especially, well, and the thing is, this is one of the things, we are a very young culture in the West, especially here in the U.S., and so we are naive.
Right.
You know, you get traditions in Asia, and they know this stuff. Yes, there is this great lineal tradition dating back, you know, 1,500 years, and every single guru in that tradition has done his own twist on it.
That's also very true, yeah.
You know, they're not just Xeroxing each other's performance.
Right.
They're all doing their own things. And that's what makes an actual tradition healthy.
Yeah.
You know, a tradition that's healthy, people should be, or it's like, oh, like in the martial arts, you know, you'll have, you know, a martial artist in such and such style. And yeah, but watch the way he throws that punch. It's not like anything else, and don't get in the way of it.
Right, right. Yeah, and every person's different. Every person has a different logical chart, for instance. But like, some people like working with plants more. Some people like working with animals. Some people like working with more of the shamanic, that kind of that
spirit
work. Some, you know, yeah. So there, some people like making artifacts and talismans. So yeah, everyone is different. But it also is good to like learn a system or a tradition well before you start.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Just so you don't simply recycle your own imbalances and your own failings into yourself. Yeah, I always recommend anybody who wants to get into magic should start by learning some existing system and get good at it. And then you'll know enough to be able to tinker.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Well, yeah, this has been a wonderful talk, JMD. Glad that you were able to be on the show again, and really excited.
I'm glad I was.
This book, you know.
Yeah, let's show the audience.
Yeah,
this was a very fun book to write. I am quite fortunate because I have a couple of, I've been able to get some the information to put together some books that I think are going to be really, really popular and really interesting that deal with some of these older traditions that have been largely forgotten. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how it goes.
Well, great. And yeah, so thank you again, and cheers.